Trust us, we're all anxious as fuck. We've been there. Hi, I'm Rachel Handler, and welcome to Lady Problems, where every Thursday, me and a rotating crew of ladies look at the way pop culture treats women with the women who make pop culture. This week actually marks our first season finale, which is both sad and exciting for us because we'll have one less excuse to lure all of the women we're obsessed with into our studio and talk to them, but more time to troll Jeremy Renner on Twitter. And we'll be back soon. So, you know, catch up with us sometime this summer. My co-host this week is Teo Bugby. Hello, Teo.
Hi.
And Teo and I are here to talk to Aparna Nancherla. Hi, Aparna.
Hi, guys.
Aparna is one of our favorite comedians. We're so honored to host her today. Her comedy takes many forms. She does stand-up. She's a writer. She has an amazing Twitter. She's written for Late Night with Seth Meyers and for Totally Biased. She's been on Inside Amy Schumer and Netflix's Love. She has a web series about the horrors of entering your 30s. She has a podcast called Blue Women Group, a Comedy Central special. I could go on, but instead we will just let her speak. We're going to talk to Aparna about her career, about how she wrings comedy from things like depression and anxiety, and what it's like to write comedy for herself versus comedy for dudes. Later, we'll talk to her about comedy in the Trump era, what's funny, what's not, what the responsibilities of a comedian are, and how we can make him feel very bad about himself on Twitter. Aparna, so pretend that our listeners have no idea who you are and we've booked you irresponsibly without knowing who you are. How would you introduce yourself or characterize your work?
I would say I'm a comedian based in New York City. I also I guess I tweet a lot. I'm on Twitter pretty constantly. And then I've been doing some writing stuff. Like I've written for a couple shows, and I've also been lucky enough to do some acting recently. I had a part come out on Love on Netflix, their second season, and then on the new HBO show Crashing.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know about that one.
Exciting to look forward to.
Yeah. So when did you first realize that you were funny? Like you were like, okay, this is actually something I could do.
I mean, I feel like I stumbled on it later in life than most people. Like I definitely was a shy kid, so I wasn't like the class clown or anything, but I was someone who was like very in my head, and I had a very wild imagination. I would like write a lot of stories and keep a lot of journals. And then as I got older, people would sort of tell me, oh, you kind of see the world in a funny way. And that's when I sort of linked that I was like funny with what I wrote, because I think when you're really shy, it's like you don't necessarily have that audience feedback. And it's like until you start opening up that you're like, oh, people laugh at things I say, so maybe there's something here.
Totally.
Yeah.
Usually when we have people on our show, it's usually like a director and they bring their one movie, or an actor and they bring their one TV show.
Yeah.
But in preparing for this interview with you, you do 8 million things. can you tell us about your hustle and like how you've managed to put all of this stuff together?
Sure. I started comedy primarily through stand-up, and I did that by just going to open mics. I started in Washington, D.C., so that was sort of just one foot in front of the other. But this was like just like when social media was starting to take off. It was way back when. like MySpace was big, and it was just like when people were putting themselves online to like help promote their work. And so I feel like I was sort of able to get in on that early and join Twitter like at the beginning. And it was just like when people were starting to get noticed for their like internet presence. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it was a good time to be like, oh, I guess I can do stuff besides stand up to sort of put myself out there. So I didn't really think when I joined Twitter that it would become like a big thing for me. But I think I just like took to the medium. And so I feel like Twitter has helped me with a lot of different job opportunities, both like writing and acting and just meeting people I look up to. And I think with comedy, the nice thing is like if people see your stand-up, they can be like, oh, like your voice or your persona might be good for this other thing I'm doing. So it kind of opens up opportunities that you wouldn't have necessarily seen for yourself. So in that way, it's kind of good because I'm bad at setting goals generally, so it's nice when I don't have to make those decisions.
I think every job I've gotten that was a real job and not like selling knives door to door.
Yeah. Oh, I did that too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Cut-co? Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think every job I've gotten besides that has been from Twitter. And it is really nice, like, when people just give it to you.
For sure. Yeah. You like just have to show up.
It's interesting because, I mean, you've been doing this for 10 years or so.
Yeah. I think I just passed 11.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so, but it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, that you're really, now is kind of like your moment.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
What do you attribute that to?
I don't know. I mean, I do feel like with stand-up, it's normal to like for 10 years to be when you actually start to hit your stride. Like, I guess that seems like a long time, but I think it just takes that long to really hone in on what you want to say and what you want to do and for people to like learn who you are. And of course, some people gain, you know, fame or like success a lot faster. Some people it takes longer, but I think it's stand-up is like one of those things where you can't really rush it for yourself. Like, you can't just suddenly be great at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to sort of find your way there. So I kind of like that about it because you can't really – there's not really a shortcut.
It does seem like kind of a horror movie concept, the idea of the first time you do stand-up all of a sudden you're famous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, and I feel like – that exists now, not in terms of stand-up, but, like, just with, like, people who go viral or something and they suddenly have their, like, moment in the spotlight, and I feel like it can so often go wrong or something. yeah, I feel like who am I thinking of? Like, Chewbacca Mom or something? Where I just feel like it just was too much too quickly.
The pressure got to her.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Azalea Banks.
Yeah.
That's the one that really kills her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Azalea Banks, yes.
Wow, that's true. Wow, it's bleak. You've done a lot of writing for male comedians, like, outside mm-hmm. of just yourself. And I'm curious, like, what are the dynamics of writing for men versus writing for yourself? Is there any, like, I feel like if it were me, I'd be, like, slightly bitter about it. Like, I feel like I don't want a man taking my joke.
Yeah, I think anytime you're writing for someone else, there's definitely, like, a learning curve because you have to kind of meet the halfway point between their sensibility and yours. And I think mine is definitely a little bit more outside the box. So it's, for me, been harder to sort of conform to a more maybe, like, broader worldview because I'm a little bit specific. And I think with men, then there's that additional filter of like, and what if I was a man saying this? So I feel like sometimes that can be hard for me. But you kind of learn through trial and error and experience. And I think I've gotten lucky in that now people sort of know my voice better. And they're kind of like, oh, maybe you wouldn't be the best person to, like, you know, write for Jimmy Fallon or something, mm-hmm. where it's like, it's probably better if you just do something that's more Aparna.
Right.
Yeah. So that's been like a weird, like, at first it was hard, but it's like once you sort of break through a little bit, it's kind of nice that people know what they're getting from you.
Totally.
Yeah.
How do you get into a man's head? What do you think to yourself?
Great question. You know, it's a lot of, like, what if everything was just going great? You're just handed a bunch of things, people high-fiving you all the time. No, I don't know.
Noticing less.
Yes, notice just being
life is a blur.
Default. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think a lot of it is, like, more what you avoid talking about, which sounds weird, but it's, like, don't talk about being a woman, you know, or like don't talk about like the wage gap because it's probably not what you would bring up.
I would love to see Jimmy Fallon like do a monologue about the wage gap written by you.
People would take it more seriously.
More Lady Problems after this break.
So you've actually been doing a weekly stand-up show in New mm-hmm. York for a really long time. And I think we were looking it up and it said that it's the longest running stand-up show in New York.
It is. And it's not technically my show. Like, it's a show that's been running a long time and they've sort of cycled through different hosts. I think originally it was a show called Crash Test, and I think it was like Aziz Ansari and like Paul Scheer and maybe Rob Hubel all ran it at UCB, right, when they were sort of hitting their stride. And then I think after they all moved to LA, the guy who helped them book it, Jeremy Levenbach, he turned it into this, because he kind of wanted to keep it going. It had a built-in audience, so he changed the name to Whiplash. Jeremy, like, asked me if I wanted to host it semi-regularly, and I was like, of course. It's, like, a great show, and it has a, like, great audience that comes every week, and it's, like, I was like, of course I'll do this fun show that every week, yeah. So that's how I sort of ended up being there.
When you have, like, such a regular, like, grind of doing work mm-hmm. and in so many different mediums, does it ever get, like, overwhelming to be doing comedy about depression and anxiety? I know, like, for me at least, yeah. I, like, love talking about depression.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I'll hit, like, my max and it's like, for I can't sure. talk about this ever again anymore.
Oh, yeah. No, I get that. I definitely go through cycles with it. Like, sometimes I first started writing about it because I was, like, struggling with depression. I was kind of like, well, you're having trouble, like, creating anything else. Maybe just try to write about it. And then that's, like, what made me first, like, sort of bring it into my act. And then, but then I will go through periods where I'm just, like, I don't want to talk about this part of my life. And it's, like, I'll try to write about anything but that. So I think it's a weird push and pull between, like, making yourself vulnerable and then being, like, okay, that's enough for now.
Yeah, I yeah. think what's interesting about the way that you talk about depression and anxiety is, like, there's this sort of cliche of the comic, like, the sad comic, mm-hmm. and you don't fall into any of that. Like, all of your jokes are extremely fresh and original. I'm curious, like, where are you thinking, like, okay, I want to figure out a way to talk about depression, or is it just something that's naturally kind of funny to you?
I think it's naturally interesting to me because I think – in general, I tend to, like, when I am depressed or when I am in a more, like, thoughtful mood, I immediately go to, like, the existential questions of, like, what's the point? Like, why are we all here? And I think that's why my comedy ends up being a lot about, like, the day-to-day and the mundane stuff, because I feel like that's what ends up taking up the majority of our lives, like, in between the, like, bigger milestones or, like, memories. It's just, like, all this little stuff. So I think I find that the most interesting. So I think I'm always trying to sort of combine the little things with, like, what does that mean in the bigger scale of things? And I feel like that's very much a depressive mindset. It's, like, very, like, why did I just, you know, why do I get up? And, like, yeah, I don't know.
We can all, this is extremely relatable content here.
It's true. I think yeah. that's probably 60% of our writing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
It always
oh,
gets,
good.
Like, very dark.
Yeah. No, that's, like, my comfort zone, I
yes,
think.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, you have this podcast, The Blue Woman Group, which is mm-hmm. about, I think there's only been a few episodes.
Yeah, it was, like, a very short, we sort of tried to do a second season, but it's sort of because of our schedules been stalled a little bit. But it was just three episodes, and it was just me and another comedian, Jacqueline Novak, who is also, like, pretty open about her depression. She and I just wanted to do a podcast about it that was a little bit less serious, or, like, we felt like all the other mental health podcasts we had heard were a little bit more in depth about, like, people's lives and interviews, and we kind of wanted to do just something with the two of us that was more about, like, being a depressive on a day-to-day mm-hmm. level and just, like, navigating different areas like work and, like, social media. And so I think that's how we sort of landed on that idea.
The workplace one is so amazing.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God, where oh, you're, like, so speaking nice. Over the meditative oh, tapes.
It's true, yeah.
You're in the hallway.
Oh,
you're
I'm
in
so
the stairwell. Did you guys improvise that?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, my God.
That was very impressive. Much in the moment.
I listened to that episode in our office, which is an open floor plan office, and it's
oh
me sitting
gosh.
There just, like, clutching the sides of the seat, loving life.
Oh. I mean, you see these lights, Aparna. Look at this.
They're,
this is fucking bullshit.
No, I know. They're so harsh.
These beautiful
so
beige walls.
And we're literally in a padded room right
we
now.
We are. No windows.
Perfect.
The Lady Problems listeners can get a glimpse of the landscape.
Right. Very depressive workplace. You like have this great way of making fun of other people's podcasts. Like I think I read something where you're like, I'm making a podcast for no reason, like everybody else. And we were like, holy shit, like please critique our podcast.
Oh no.
I would love to hear how you think we've been doing so far.
Oh no, it's been great because I feel like I've gotten, and I'm not just saying that, because I feel like I've, as a comedian, you're asked to do a lot of podcasts because I think, I guess they kind of took off specifically in the comedy world. And I feel like there are a lot of them that aren't really about anything. It's mm-hmm. almost like they're like, let's just set up the mics and just talk, you know? And then it's like, why are we here? Like, of course, that's where my mind goes anyway. But right. like...
no, but like, that's a good creative here? Question. Like, yes, sometimes yes. being depressive winds up being good for work.
Right, right. It gives you a little bit more impetus to have direction.
A
but,
point.
Yeah. So I think even in just having a name that tells you something about what you're going to hear, you guys are way ahead of
Thank
the game.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that review. Yeah. It means a lot to us. Aparna, you wrote this great piece in The Village Voice in December called Comedians in the Age of Trump, Forget Your Stupid Toupee Jokes. Why should comedians forget their stupid toupee jokes?
Sure. I think I, like a lot of people, like after the election, was kind of struggling with like what I wanted to talk about and like how I wanted to proceed. Because I think I and I found this in speaking to other comedians, like we kind of felt like doing comedy just felt kind of dumb because it's like all the way up to the election, we were all like very vocally like, you know, we're going to vote and don't let Trump win or whatever, but it was still like not, I don't think anyone actually thought he would win, and then he did, and it was kind of like, what do we do now? Like, it, like, what is, we thought comedy can, like, you know, create change, but it, like, didn't work in this capacity, so it's like, what do we do going forward? And I think, for me, it's mainly, like, trying to actually, you know, write material about stuff I believe in and like try to support like causes that might be threatened right now because mm-hmm. I feel like it's more immediate than it might have felt like before, and to just have more of a conscientiousness about like what I'm doing with my time on stage. Yeah, both in like, you know, giving voice to groups that might not have that right now, and also just not downplaying, like, the severity of what's happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you found that there's, like, material that just doesn't play now?
Sometimes. I mean, I've been trying to talk about, like, how I feel politically and what I've been trying to do or what I've been thinking about. And sometimes you feel the room tense up. And sometimes I've just tried to push through it because I'm like, this is where we're at. Like, I know it might not be hilarious right now, but it feels disingenuous to not talk about it. So, yeah, I think I have been finding, like, just through trial and error, like, what feels good and what is still needs work to be funny. But, yeah, it's kind of an ongoing process.
What's something that's, like, really been working for you? Like, a joke that's really been working for you about Trump or about this dystopian era that we now live in?
I have this joke about anxiety where I'm like, I'm someone who deals with a lot of anxiety, and it is nice that it's like finally on message. It's like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like as an anxious person, you're like, this is what we trained for. Like, this it's happening finally. And I feel like that one seems to strike a chord with people. So I'm like, oh, good. I'm not alone. But yeah, so that's just a little one.
It is true that, like, coaching friends who are really upset about this,
totally.
Like, how to get out of bed in the morning, it's like, I've
yeah,
got this.
Yeah, you're like, I'm a pro. Like,
it does feel, yeah, that's such a good point. I was talking about that with a friend recently, too, and she was like, I miss being a child when, like, I was so carefree. And I was like, dude, I was never carefree.
No.
Like, I feel so happy to be an adult because my worries are real.
Right, right, right. Like, finally people will take you seriously.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was weird having existential crises in elementary school.
Yeah.
I know. People are like, oh, that's cute. But you're like, no, it's real.
It's not cute. It's not cute. What's the best Trump joke that you've heard from somebody else?
Oh, I feel bad because I'm like, should I? I don't want to ruin other people's material, but Kate Berlant is this great
She's so
comic.
Funny.
She's so good. And she lives in L.A. now. She started in New York. But she just, I mean, most of her comedy is very, like, stream of consciousness and just, like, these beautiful long pieces. But she had this line about Trump where she was like, he looks like a melting candle. And he just reminds you of, like, the elasticity of time. And it's just so funny to me. I always only think of a candle now when I look at him.
He really does. There are so many amazing things to compare him to. That's one of the best things about this era.
And it's like a joke about someone's looks without really being... It's like, is it good? Is it bad? I don't know. It's it is.
Can't place judgment on a candle. Mm-mm. Do you think because Trump pays so much attention to Twitter that, like, being a comedian on Twitter who's taking shots at Trump is, like, more important? Or does he? Do you think he gives a shit?
Or do you feel like you want to lay back because it winds up getting so intense sometimes for people who wind up criticizing him?
Yeah, I mean, I notice, like, with his stuff, a lot of times it'll be, like, someone will retweet it and then add, like, commentary on top of that, like, quote it. And I feel like there are people who do that really well. So I generally don't, like, go straight for his tweets, but I will sort of comment on things he said, like, in a more indirect way. But it is strange. It still feels very surreal that it's, like, he's on Twitter. He's, like... posting tweets and, like, mm-hmm. I sort of imagine
he totally checks his retweets too.
You think so?
Oh, no doubt.
No, you're right. He has to. He's like a business guy, so he's like numbers.
Right.
But yeah, I was like, I can't imagine he reads his at replies, but maybe he does. Like, I don't know. I still can't imagine him on Twitter, and yet he is there.
There he is.
At all hours.
Every day.
At strange hours.
So haunting. Yeah, it is weird. Like, we talk about it like it's so normal, but it's extremely bizarre.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, it's full, like, upside down world.
Yes.
Like, the digital sphere has officially taken over our politics and lives.
Yeah. Horrifying.
No, it's so strange.
We're getting dark as we are wont, as we all want to do.
But it's also, like, a thing where I feel like... you know, you see celebrities on Twitter in terms of, like, actors and other people, and they're commenting on things. And there's still, like, a layer of removal where you're just like, so Kim Kardashian is tweeting, but there's still, like, a layer of removal. But I feel like when it's the president, it's just like, what? Like, this isn't, like, this isn't entertainment anymore. It's, like, actual stuff.
Yeah.
It is actual stuff.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like, with Trump comedy, that there – do you ever get freaked out by the idea of people capitalizing on it? You know what I mean? Sometimes I think I get anxious about the idea that – you know, like the sort of NBC thing of, like, it's good for the news. It's good for the ratings.
Right. Like, people, like, are watching no matter what.
Right.
A little bit. Like, I am concerned, but I think I'm more concerned about just, like, changing the situation overall. And then it's like, there'll always be stuff to write about afterward, you know? Like, it's like, nobody needs comedy that badly that you're like, let's put a psychopath in office. Like, it doesn't seem worth the trade-off.
More lady problems after this break. So we have two lady problems today. The first one is from our co-host, Hazel Sills, who's not here today.
Cool.
She has a very specific issue with men. Blanking on her in public. She'll tell us about it.
Hi, Lady Problems. It is your lovely co-host, Hazel, calling in with a problem. So I keep having these experiences where I'm out with my boyfriend and we meet a guy or someone he knows, and he will just not introduce himself to me or say hi, just, or maybe take, like, too long of a time to, like, say hello to me or even get my name. And it's kind of confusing because it's like, if you are saying hello to my boyfriend and I'm right next to him, like, why wouldn't you ask me what my name is if we've never met? And it's something I've actually heard, like, has happened to some friends of mine or other girls that I know, when I've brought this sort of phenomenon up with men, they will say, oh, he's just socially awkward. Like, oh, that guy is just so awkward. And it's weird because, like, he's not, this guy wasn't awkward with my boyfriend or the men that we were with or around. So when someone says it's socially awkward, I'm just like, well, maybe it's just misogyny. Like, it's a two-part problem, I guess, because it's what do I do when this happens again? And then what do I say to men who just write it off as being social awkwardness and not something more serious? Thank you, ladies. I'm looking forward to your answer to my problem. Bye.
Bye, Hazel. I love Hazel.
What do you think, Aparna?
That's a good one, because I feel like, or good question, rather, not a good thing to happen. It does feel like something that's a microaggression, but that's probably not intentional. Like, it's almost like the way we've been socialized, where it's like, you know, back in the day where it's like men's wives just like showed up with them and they could just be like background while the men had the important words or whatever. But yeah, clearly it's like out of date, and nor should it ever have occurred. But like, I think for what she should do, I feel like sometimes with these things you have to overcorrect. So I think she has to sort of take the lead and be like, hi, I'm Hazel, and not give them a chance to sort of blank her. But yeah, I don't think the social awkwardness is a legitimate excuse.
No. Yeah, you're just not going to keep not introducing yourself to women forever.
Yeah. Because that's like, are you only valuing women if they're, you know, available to you, like, as a potential romantic? It makes you look bad on multiple levels.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I have friends who are, I mean, friends in quotes, who are like that. Like, they only will speak to women if they're capable of fucking them.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely on the page of overcorrecting. Like, right. Hazel's a nicer person than me. If it were me, I would be like, hello.
I know.
What the fuck? Like, I'm standing here. Yeah. And I have done that. Yeah. It makes me so, because this happens to me all the time with my boyfriend, too.
Right.
It's just like an infuriating phenomenon.
I will say that my advice in this situation usually would be don't have a boyfriend or don't talk to men. However, I will say, actually, the most intense situation like this I've ever gotten into was somebody who, I was at a party that was like a queer birthday party, and I was talking to a guy who wouldn't make eye contact with me, and it was really wild in a, like, in a queer setting where it's a totally different gendered dynamic,
right?
But still there exists this kind of reticence to introduce yourself or to acknowledge that there's actually a third person in the conversation who isn't a man.
Yeah, I've also noticed sometimes, like, with male comedians, like, if their girlfriend comes along to a show or something and is, like, hanging out with them, like, they won't introduce her and she'll sort of just be there. And it's like, if I want to meet her, I have to, like, approach her myself. And I'm kind of like, why are you not treating her like a person? Right. Like, it's almost like she's just, like, your little bag you brought along that we're just supposed to look at. And it's weird because the opposite isn't true. Like, if I brought a guy to a show, like, they would introduce themselves to him. So I'm like, it's definitely a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So what should Hazel do? I think she should murder this man.
I mean,
I agree.
I'm a huge advocate.
Yeah. Great. I'm glad we all agree. Okay. So the second is from a Twitter user who tweeted this at us when we said that you were going to be on the show. Her name is EGK, which is a very interesting name. She said, I think other people's judgments hold me back from taking chances, but I also think that blows. How do I conquer my fear?
Ooh.
I know, it's a big question.
I know. That feels like a lifelong
If you find struggle. Out, EGK, please tell us.
But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing with comedy is, like, at some point, and maybe any creative field, it's like you're going to get a lot of people saying they don't care for you or they don't think you're funny. And so I think at some point you have to make peace with, like, how you're going to navigate other people's feedback or opinions, because you get a lot of unsolicited feedback, I feel like, especially in comedy. People feel like they can comment on it. And I think for me, it was kind of separating, like, what I do from people's reaction to it. Like, I'm not responsible for how you feel about my work. I'm only responsible for my work. So that's, like, all I can do. And I can't write for your taste because I don't know you as a person. Like, I can only write what I think is funny or, like, feels inspiring to me. So now we're trying to please everyone.
Right. Yeah. It's like the Twitter eggs of your life.
Yes, exactly.
Just ignore them.
They're all
put
Twitter
them on
eggs.
It's also like if you had somebody else's approval, then you would just worry about, like,
someone else.
The another. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. The next egg.
Probably, like, your idea of what people will say is way worse than what people would ever say, because you're your own worst critic generally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she had a second part to her question,
oh,
which is much more specific and tangible. How old is too old to have your parents do your taxes?
Oh, that's a great question.
Well, apparently last year for me.
It's over for you?
They didn't say that, but I said
you
that
decided.
To myself. Yeah, exactly.
I think I did. My parents took care of my taxes for a long time. Like, I think a few years out of college, maybe. But yeah, I got an accountant finally, so I still don't feel like I really ever took ownership of them. I just hand them to a different adult.
A different person.
Yeah.
I also just got an accountant.
Yeah.
Until then, I just was like sending all my stuff to my mom.
Does it count as doing it yourself if you do TurboTax, or is TurboTax
that totally
my account?
Counts. No, that counts.
Okay, great. Then I'm doing my taxes
yeah.
this year.
So impressed.
That's my plan for the weekend, actually.
That's
a
great.
Hot weekend in.
No, that's, you're way ahead of the game.
Let your parents take care of you if they want to.
Yes.
Let them do anything that
except
you want them
love.
To love.
In all its forms.
Thank you to my co-host, Teo Bugby.
Thank you, Rachel.
And to Aparna and Chirla for hanging out with us.
Thank you, guys.
Aparna, where can people find you and your work and everything?
So my website is pretty easy. It's just aparnacomedy.com. And then my Twitter handle is pretty good for where I list shows and stuff. It's just Apar Napkin. So it's APAR Napkin.
Why Apar Napkin?
I mean, I don't really have a good reason. I joined Twitter before people were, like, using it as a promotional tool. So I was still in the silly username end of things.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have now officially concluded the final episode of our first season of Lady Problems. We are all going to take some time off to reignite the feminist rage in our hearts and come back to you this summer with a lot of shit to talk. We love you very much and we'll miss you dearly. But considering we're approaching the season of men writing ads telling you to get skinny for the beach, please consider backloading us with all of your lady problems while we're gone. Give us a call at 205-677-5239. That's 205-677-LADY. Or tweet us at Lady Problems Pod. And please be sure to give us a rating or leave us a review on iTunes just so we know that we're still alive. I'm Rachel Handler, and thank you so much for listening to the first season of Lady Problems.
This episode of Lady Problems was produced by Michael Catano, James T. Green, Mukta Mohan, and Kasia Mihailovic for the MTV Podcast Network, with additional engineering by Little Everywhere. You can subscribe to this and all of our other shows on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you find your favorite podcasts.